reading from the Gospel of Luke. I'll be reading from Eugene Peterson's Bible entitled The Message. Best translation out there. Jesus left the Jordan and was led into the wilderness. For 40 wilderness days and nights he was tested by the devil. He ate nothing during those days. When the time was up, he was hungry. The devil, playing on his hunger, gave test number one. Command that this stone turn into a loaf of bread. Jesus answered, it takes more than bread to really live. For the second test, the devil led him up and spread out all the kingdoms of the earth on display. And the devil said, they are yours in all their splendor to serve your pleasure. I'm in charge of them all, and I can turn them over to whomever I wish. Worship me, and they are yours, the whole works. Jesus refused, backing his refusal with Deuteronomy, worship the Lord and only the Lord. Serve him with absolute single-heartedness. For the third test, the devil took him to Jerusalem and put him up on top of the temple. He said, if you're God's son, jump. It's written, isn't it, that he has placed you in the care of angels to protect you. They will catch you. You won't so much as stub your toe on a stone. Yes, said Jesus, and it's also written, don't you dare tempt the Lord your God. That completed the testing. The devil retreated temporarily, lying in wait for another opportunity. Once upon a time, a future time, Bill Gates dies. He goes to purgatory, and at the entrance stands St. Peter. Pete says to Bill, you know, I can't decide whether to send you to heaven or hell. You've served so many people's needs, putting affordable devices in homes and schools, and your foundation has been very generous, but you know, you really messed up when you made that gosh-awful Windows Vista. So I'll make you a deal. You can decide where to go, make a test visit to both places, then make up your mind where you want to stay. Sounds great, says Bill. Where should I go first? Pete says, it's your choice. Bill says, okay, I think I'll try hell first. Bill and Pete go to hell. A sparkling sandy beach. Turquoise water, gentle waves, bikini-clad folks, free drinks at the bar. This looks great. Bill says to Pete, if this is hell, now I really want to see heaven. Fine, says Pete. Off they go. They arrive in heaven. High in the clouds, angels drifting about, shopping mall muzak. Each of heaven's residents has their own cubicle, state-of-the-art devices linked to every other resident of heaven. A dozen flat panel monitors tuned into sports and entertainment channels, voice recognition software to place an order for any food that one desires. There's even a porta potty in each cubicle. It's a self-contained universe. Heaven also looks agreeable to Bill Gates, even though it does resemble his home east of Seattle. Yet it's not quite as enticing as what hell seemed to offer. So Bill makes his decision. I think I'd prefer hell. As you wish, says Pete. Bill Gates goes to hell. Well, a couple of weeks later, Pete decides to check in on how the late billionaire is doing. He finds Bill shackled to a wall in a dark cave. He is screaming among flames, little red demons running around with pitchforks. Well, how's it going? Pete asks Bill. Bill screams, this stinks. This is nothing like the hell you showed me. What happened to that other place with free drinks and so forth? Oh, that, says Bill, well, that was just a demo. Next month, this congregation will spend a week in thoughtful conversations with your candidate. Candidating week is a demo in an important sense from both the congregation's and minister's perspective. You will aspire to be at your best, speaking well of what matters most to you. And this demo period is essential to your thoughtful reflection, Through the outstanding work of your search committee, you will soon be poised to move ahead deliberately and in the spirit of celebration. So what's this in my title about liberating nonsense? That phrase has at least a half a dozen meanings, of which we'll look at maybe a couple in these moments. Is ministry truly nonsensical? My colleague, Reverend Edward Frost, now retired, describes a fundamental dilemma of ministry. It's what he calls the Father Mulcahy complex. While others in the field hospital are being useful, stopping the flow of blood, reattaching severed limbs, and jump-starting stilled hearts, Father Mulcahy stands aside, looking anxious, trying to stay out of the way until the real professionals arrive to do useful work. Oh, Father Mulcahy has his place. He counsels the frightened young soldiers. He gives last rites. It's cosmic work from one point of view. Still, that doesn't count much. Secular society does not value the Father Mulcahy's highly on the productive employment scale. TV commercials put us a cut above the Maytag repairman. We are portrayed as cute, chubby old idiots who like snack crackers of a certain kind and who can't get ourselves on an airplane without help. And Reverend Frost goes on, as far as our non-traditional Unitarian Universalism, ministers' value is even more ambiguous. Ours is a religion most people have never heard of and don't understand if they have. Whenever I'm on a flight someplace and my seatmate asks what I do, I sometimes say that I manufacture rawhide dog chews. It gets us onto a manageable conversation. It's not far off. I want something I can get my teeth into. Sure. I want to return to our reading. The fable. Of course it's a fable. The Bible is not history. It wasn't meant to be. It's a fable about temptations. Why should this story matter to you and me? I'm not sure, but I think these temptations may have something to do with a central dilemma in our congregations, namely the sometimes impossible expectations that you and I have of one another with very good intentions. Recall the story. Temptation number one. If you are who you say you are, command that these stones turn into bread. What's that about? Is this about magic? There's a more profound meaning. If the Rabbi Yeshua had wanted to succeed, to be admired and approved, the surefire solution would be to stir up a tasty assortment of quick fast food, some tender McNuggets, or perhaps some bumper stickers in Aramaic that could be tied onto the backs of his listeners' donkeys as they rode home, or some souvenir t-shirts to wear in case they were to arrive home and old Grandpa Abraham said, "Well, what did you learn from that old preacher out there today? Did he give you anything useful?" At least there will be some snappy one-liners. Something to satisfy those who want to know, was this guy any good? Give me some McNuggets. Or maybe some dog chews, something I can gnaw on. That's the first temptation. Crowds of admirers might appreciate Yeshua for a while, snacking on morsels of cliches. Cliches, banalities, and slogans, and other forms of intellectual fast food goes down fast like Chinese tea, but not much nutrition. People will eventually crave some depth. Temptation number two, what was it? Come with me. I'm going to show you all the power that could be yours if you'd like to have it. That's enticing. Any public figure, such as this first century rabbi, with a compelling social message speaking against injustice, against exploitation and abuse, surely they would wish their message to be heard, to be proclaimed a champion of righteousness, a visible force in the community, maybe with appearances on Charlie Rosenwolf Blitzer, a guest hosting gig at Saturday Night Live, with a well-connected agent. This Rabbi Yeshua could spread the word, pack in the crowds, boost revenues and attendance figures, and capitalize on his power of persuasion. He could give prayers and PowerPoint at the Rotary Club in Jericho and be in the chair of honor at the mayor of Nazareth's prayer breakfast if he is well connected. May even get a three-way debate with Rachel Maddow and Bill O'Reilly. Who knows? All he needs is the right marketing and connections. Rabbi Yeshua's core message was, love your enemies. This message is unheard of in the ancient Near East. Then as now, distinctions of black and white, good and evil, were just as harsh then as they are now. But Jesus' message blew all these notions sky high because he didn't hang out with beautiful people and connected people. He hung out with the dredges, those who were despised. So temptation number two says, if you are well connected with the right agent and network, your message is going to spread, you will succeed. And Yeshua's answer was that, no, I don't think I'm going to pick a fight. His hearers wanted him to say, let's you and them fight so that we can feel good about ourselves. He said, that's not where I'm at. Love your enemies. Temptation three was, in a way, the supreme temptation. And it may sound a bit strange. Then the devil took him to the pinnacle of the temple. They were standing up there on top of the temple. The devil said, if you are who you are, who you say, jump. Nothing's going to hurt you. People will protect you. Is this another magic trick? Defying gravity. Sprouting wings. We must look beyond the literal account. This temptation says, you can do it all. Be what you want to be. You are invincible. You're not going to crash and burn. After all, you ran the Haifa Marathon. You grow organic vegetables. You study the law. Your devotional life is intact. You do continuing ed every April. You put in 16-hour days. You overfunction, and you can do it. So go get it. You're invincible. Be Superwoman. Be Superman. I shall overfunction and rescue every need that is crying for my attention. Go ahead, Superwoman, Superman, you can do it. We'll catch you. In Luke's fable, the tempter is the devil. For me, that tempter isn't out there someplace, it's in here. These voices are lurking in me, appealing to my vanity and pride. The temptation to gain quick approval by offering McNuggets and quick fixes. The temptation to appeal to humanity's propensity to pick fights and go get them. And the temptation to rescue, to overfunction, to take a leap and be all things to all people. Here I speak only for myself. I have no presumptions about whether this could be true of any of you, but as time goes on, and in staying in touch with my colleagues as I do, I see that ministry and its sometimes unrealistic expectations And in its ecstasies of celebration, it's about all of us. It's about how each of us can learn to put some boundaries on those functions which can compromise and undermine our integrity. A quick story, and then I'll conclude. My colleague, Robert Fulgham, once led a group of Sunday school kids in a game called Giants, Wizards, and Dwarfs. The purpose of this game, Fulgham says, is to make a lot of noise and run around chasing each other. Sound familiar? Until nobody knows which side you're on. Nobody knows who won. So one day, after organizing the kids into teams and explaining the game, the chaos got out of control. So Fulgham blew a whistle and he yelled at the kids, "All right, you got to decide now, which are you? Are you a giant or a wizard or a dwarf? Those are your choices." And he writes, "While the kids huddled in small groups, a tug came at my pants leg. A little girl stands there looking up at me and asks me, 'Where do the mermaids stand?'" You see, I'm a mermaid. "There are no such things as mermaids in this game," I reply. "Oh, yes, they are. I am one." Fulgham responds, "I said the right thing next. I said, 'Of course you're a mermaid. You come over here and stand next to me. Next to the king of the sea. That's who I am.'" He expanded the game. Friends, I'm losing my voice. I'm not going to subject you anymore. It's time to wrap it up anyway.